Sling is the live TV service that puts you in charge. Choose your plan. Orange for sports and entertainment favorites, blue for news and reality, or select for the essentials. Only pay for the stuff you actually watch. And pause your subscription anytime because paying for TV or not watching? That's just rude. No long-term contracts, no nonsense. Pick your plan, add what you want. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Gut stuff might be uncomfortable for you to talk about, but it's even more uncomfortable for you to deal with. And you have better things to do this year. Don't let your gut get in the way of that. Kick off the Year of the Habit and get science-backed digestive support during Ritual's New Year's sale. Their 3-in-1 clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotic help support a balanced gut microbiome. The delayed release capsule is designed to help reach the colon where probiotics can actually survive and grow, so you can focus less on your gut and more on sharpening your salsa dancing skills or whatever your 2026 goals are. Start a habit that sticks with 40% off your first month, plus a free gift with purchase at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Hard Shoulder.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range. Celebrating 100 years of passion for the road. Recharge your soul.
Well, joining me now is bassist Stephen Travers, formerly of the Miami Show Band. The band were returning from a show in Banbridge, County Down, when they were stopped along the road by a loyalist gang and ambushed. Three of his bandmates, Fran O'Toole, Brian McCoy and Tony Geraghty, were killed. His recently published book, The Bass Player, explores his two lives before the ambush and his life afterwards. And he joins us to discuss it now. You're very welcome to the programme, Stephen. Thank you for coming in.
You
call this book a love letter and a eulogy for that first life that you had, because you do very much divide your life, don't you, into before and after.
Actually, it's Alexander Orton who said that. You know, it's a eulogy and a love letter, because she's the producer of the Netflix documentary, and when she wrote the foreword, she put it like that. But she's spot on, as usual. I mean, Ali is very, very bright. When I told her that I intended to write a second book, as I thought it was going to be, to fill in the gaps between the first book, 2007, and now, she said, "Well, I know the story. I know what happened from the, you know, from the documentary," because she worked on that as a producer for about the best part of 3 years. And also, you know, various things. The first book, which that was probably a lot of it was based on. But she said, "Now I want to know how it affected you." So, you know, the minute she said that, I knew what I had to write about, rather than just updating it. So the book is effectively an answer, a reply to what Alexander Orton said. You know?
Let's go back to, I suppose, 1974, let's say, the year before the massacre. You're a young man in your early 20s who loves the bass and loves playing music and loves performing, and you join the Miami Show Band. What was that like?
Well, in 74, Anne and I had just got married. We built a house in Carrigan, South Tipperary, and so, you know, we were sort of no responsibilities. So you know, you say I was 24. I was actually in 74. I was 23, as my mother would have said, 23 going on 13. You know, neither of the two of us had any sense. You can imagine the way it was then, the music, great music, and I was sort of jumping in and out of various bands and different bands, and I was sort of in demand. I was climbing up the totem pole. My primary thing for me was you know, to learn as much as I could about the bass. I was in love with the bass, you know, and you can imagine Anne, she's like, I was punching well above my weight there. She's beautiful and always is, still is. And she's, you know, the cheesecloth skirts on the girls and the headbands and all. You know, we were like, It was fairyland, really, you know. And
you were living the dream when you were asked to join the Miami Show Band. You said it was a big deal for a young man to be asked to join a band that was that established, that was that famous.
Well, ironically, Kira, what happened was they headhunted me in 74, and I turned them down. They asked me to play lead guitar, and I'm a bass player. And, you know, asking a bass player to play lead, they're two different animals. You know, it's like asking a plumber to fix your electrics, you know. So I was happy enough to notch that one. And, you know, they've offered me a gig. I turned it down. But they came back in 75, in May of 75. And at that stage, Anne and I had a mortgage. It was £7 a week. So I thought, you know, I better get some sense here and pay the mortgage. So I took the gig, but mainly because of who was in the band. You know, Tony Geraghty was undoubtedly, a genius. He was fabulous. Fabulous player. Fran was a great, great keyboard player. All the lads, they were a terrific band. So I said, I'll take that gig then as a bass player. Then
you were growing up then. You were making some serious decisions. You decided at the ripe old age of 24. So you sound, Stephen, like you were in a very happy place in your life.
Yeah.
You were married, you joined the Miami Show Band, you were now getting to play the instrument that you adored, the bass. Who was Stephen Travers after the massacre?
I wasn't quite sure. It took me a long time. I thought I was myself. I thought, you know, when people would say to me, you know, I had to go and see if you had to get some assessment, you know, psychological assessments and things like that. And I thought that these were for, there was some sort of criminal injuries claim at that time. Basically, you were claiming the, you know, your loss of the instruments and stuff like that. And I didn't take it seriously. And I used to look at the psychiatrist, you know, and think he needed a psychiatrist, not me, you know. I thought there was no difference. But I remember during at one session, the psychiatrist said, you know, well, you know, at some stage, he said, I don't know how you've managed to get through this, you know. And he said, I think maybe you may be one in a million, but I don't think so. He said, and I used to think to myself, well, look, I went to a gig. On the way home, the lads were killed. I was injured, but I'm okay now. I'm back. But I remember his parting shot to me was, you know, one day the wall will fall on you. He said, I think it will. Unless you're, you know, like extraordinary altogether. And I used to think to myself, well, I am extraordinary. You know, I've seemed to have managed this. If he tells me I am, but it was 30 years later that the wall actually fell on me. And it was during a visit to Warrington, where those two little boys were murdered by the IRA, Tim Parry and Colin Ball, the little boys.
And, I can still see their faces.
Yeah. I looked at a picture. I was doing a residential there. I had sort of become at that stage, you know, a speaker. I was speaking for Radicalisation Awareness Network, RAN, sponsored by the EU. And but that was the one time that, you know, and the wall fell, and I outlined it in the book, the bass player, and what happened was, you know, up until then, I was able to step outside myself, even when I was talking. If I was giving a talk in a university or a convention, I travelled all over Europe. I was at two sides of the Atlantic Ocean, both sides of the equator, and I thought I was doing really well, you know, maybe helping people. But that particular time, when the wall fell, it took me about 2 years to get over it. It just happened out of the blue. I didn't expect it.
And what did that feel like?
Oh, it felt that I wasn't able to give you an example. I remember doing a talk one time, and I was in the wings of this place. It was like a big assembly hall. I was talking to a couple of school kids, you know, talking about the consequences of violence and all that. It was just a run of the mill thing as far as I was concerned, but I remember being in the wings watching this man at the microphone talking. I was thinking to myself, that's interesting. I wonder where he's going with that. It was actually me. So I was almost like an out of body experience that I could disassociate myself with this person who was who was talking about these horrible things. But on that particular time in Warrington, I wasn't able to do that, and I tried to move out, but it didn't work. So all of a sudden, I knew who I was. So that's a long way of answering your question: who was I then? Who am I now? So it's been a case of dealing with this thing now, and that's what the bass player is about. That's what Ali said, you know, when she said, "I know the story. I know what happened. Now I want to know how it affected you."
And you say your life then was defined by a terrible, premature sadness. And that word really stuck with me when I was reading it, because you were so young. So did you have to almost, Stephen, grieve the life that young Stephen Travers at 23, 24 years of age prior to this massacre, grieve the life that he could have had and learn to accept what your new reality was?
Yes, I did. Yeah, that's exactly, you know, there is a grieving process, and it's going on, you know, and this is why, you know, the subtitle of the book is, it's called The Bass Player, but the subtitle is called Surviving the Miami Showman Massacre. So, and the actual present tense there, surviving, as opposed to a survivor. So surviving indicates, you know, and that's why I came up with that subtitle. This is an ongoing process. You know, there is no cure. People talk about, you know, closure. They talk about, getting through things, and that doesn't exist. This is it's about every day is surviving. You know, surviving. So, is there? Will I ultimately survive? I don't know. Ali says, you know, in the foreword, she says, you know, maybe someday, you know, when things align properly, that I could return to the field and find that young man. And we walk hand in hand out of the thing. This is the young me before that. I don't know if that's possible, but it's something to look forward to. Maybe I can. Maybe that's the day you die. I don't know, you know, these things. But I find it interesting as well, you know.
Yeah, you have a lovely reference in the victim impact statement that you got to make after the court case that you took against the British authorities for their role in collusion in this massacre. And you settled that case, you got a sum of money, but you were allowed to make your victim impact statement. And you refer to a John Denver song, and I love John Denver. It's called Some Days Are Diamonds, but Some Days Are Stone.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, it was, I think the lyric in the song, the one that sort of, you know, why I used that was because in the book, I don't think we use the full verse, the full song, because it's for copyright, trying to be careful. But there's a line where you look in the mirror and, you know, it's about, you know, it's the person that you see is a stranger. And that sort of sums it up, you know, that you're, as you said, you know, who are you? You know, well, that's something, you know, I think we're still trying to figure out, you know, who have I become? And it's only when you sort of ask yourself these questions that you begin to be able to assess what actually happened. Because the minute, I remember lying in the field that morning, when those terrorists had gone, and Des had got up onto the road to get, so I was there for about an hour.
This was Des Lee, who survived as well.
Yeah, and I was there for about an hour because the security forces wouldn't come in. There was always a chance that that the bodies would have been booby trapped or whatever. This was apparently. So I was crawling around for an hour. I remember laying on my back. It was a beautiful morning. It must have been about 2:30, going on 3 o'clock at that stage. Just looking up at the sky and asking myself, what's just happened here, you know? I suppose, you know, I still ask myself that, you know, what just happened? But I'm not asking what just happened now. I'm asking what has happened for the past 50 years.
Can you still remember that night, that massacre, all of that detail vividly?
It's not a case of remembering. I see it all the time. This is ever present. I mean, you know, people talk about flashbacks. It isn't a case of flashbacks. This is a case of, you know, this is. I liken it to, a producer in a TV studio where he's got all the monitors, and there is one monitor there that's supposed to be sort of reality for me. that the big monitor is there. But I'm often drawn to a monitor over here at the side, which is that. So it's going on all the time. You know, it's not perhaps the one that you see or the producer tells the, you know, them to, this is the one that goes out and is broadcast, but there is another one here all the time. And you're drawn to it sometimes. And that's the danger, you know, that you're not quite sure sometimes which of them is the reality.
So sometimes you're dragged to watch that monitor and sometimes you stay longer and maybe sometimes you try and ignore it, but it's always there.
And that's perhaps the heaviest chapter in the book is called Demons, and I talk about, and I wrote it specifically. I wrote it in a specific way. There are two chapters that I wrote differently than a different style than I wrote the rest of the book. Demons is one where. Rather than try to explain what PTSD or any of these illnesses are and the attending consequences of these, so I wrote it so as to show people and to show the reader what it is like, how somebody with PTSD thinks, rather than try to explain it. Because throughout the book, If somebody's reading and they look and they listen, or they're reading, I'm talking about perhaps the court case, and because I've studied it for so long and it's been part of my life for 10 years, so the court case, and it was pretty heavy. Also things like psychological issues, and then there are, you know, the historical context that you put all of this into. You know, the reader might think that I'm some sort of expert, so throughout the book, I'm not. So what I've done throughout the book is I've peppered the book with stories of my musical adventures so as to remind the reader that they're listening to or they're reading the words of an ordinary person, a bass player, you know, it could have been any of them. So that's why I've done that. I've also, you know, I didn't write it in linear fashion, so I didn't start at the beginning and go on. What I've done is that there are chapters which talk about, say, you know, something that happened or 50 years ago, or what, and then I jump to the forward. So I'm basically asking the past to speak to the present. And this is a conversation that we need to have, you know.
Those two lives just living parallel all of the time. Stephen Travers, the book is called The Bass Player, and I really recommend that people take the time to read it. Thank you so much for coming into The Hard Shoulder. It was really lovely to meet you.
Thank you. It's great to meet you.
The Hard Shoulder with the MG Hybrid and Electric range, celebrating 100 years of passion for the road. Recharge your soul.
Gut stuff might be uncomfortable for you to talk about, but it's even more uncomfortable for you to deal with. And you have better things to do this year. Don't let your gut get in the way of that. Kick off the year of the habit and get science-backed digestive support during Ritual's New Year's sale. Their 3-in-1 clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotic help support a balanced gut microbiome. The delayed release capsule is designed to help reach the colon where probiotics can actually survive and grow, so you can focus less on your gut and more on sharpening your salsa dancing skills or whatever your 2026 goals are. Start a habit that sticks with 40% off your first month, plus a free gift with purchase at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.